We're almost done with the chapter, which means I might have trouble speaking long enough to actually fill the time. I'll see what I can do. We got up to slide 10. And in slide 10, we're looking at an x-ray of a fetus. And the main purpose of this is to show you that what I've already told you, that ossification doesn't end before birth. Babies are born with incomplete skeletons in terms of boniness, in terms of ossification. They have not yet hardened. And in the cranial bones that are listed there, we can see partial ossification. The pinker parts are ossified already, and those are bony, but we can see the prominent fontanelles between the bony parts. What kind of ossification is occurring there? What is it? I mean, without looking. Well, there's more than one person in the class. No, not if you spell it correctly. What kind of ossifications are there? There are two types.
Intramembranous.
Intramembranous ossification is the type of ossification that takes place in bones of the skull, mostly, and a little bit in the neck. But the vast majority of the skeleton gets hard by what kind of ossification?
Endochondral.
Correct. And remember that Tuesday I said that as the flat bones of the skull ossify, that ossification starts at centers of ossification, and then the hardening spreads outward. Well, just about where the two ends of those pointers are, where it says cranial bones, are two centers of ossification. A little bit farther than where the points are. The darkest parts of those bones are the centers of ossification, and it's gotten more and more bony as the ossification has spread from that center of ossification. But where you started, where you had separation of two centers of ossification, and the ossification that has spread from each of those centers has not yet run into each other, that's where you still have softness. That's what a fontanelle is. And we're only seeing a side view here, but if you were to look at the top view of a fetal skull, the fontanelles would be shaped like the head of an arrow, which is why I told the people in my lab sections that suture that develops between the two parietal bones of the skull was named the sagittal suture, because sagitt means arrow. So it's a suture that looks like an arrow, and that's what the plane is named for as well. The plane that goes through that sagittal suture is called the sagittal plane. Now, on the rest of the skeleton where you have endochondral ossification, the cartilage model, as we were talking about, is shaped just like the bone that will replace it. It's not shaped like the adult bone yet, but it's shaped just like the fetal bone that will be totally hard a little bit later. And so you can kind of imagine on the clear parts where it's not yet ossified, you can kind of see a ghost image of the rest of that model that has not yet formed. Now, why is it that never mind. You can see a lot of space, though, between boniness and still just pure cartilage. And what kind of cartilage is that? Everyone hear that? No, of course not. You have to speak as loudly as I am when you're answering confidently. What kind of cartilage is the model made out of? Did you say fiber? No. There is fibrocartilage. There is such a thing as fibrocartilage. But that's not the kind of cartilage that makes up the model. The what? It is the glassy one, but I won't accept glassy cartilage as it...
Hyaline,
right. Hyaline means glassy, but the proper name for the cartilage is hyaline cartilage. So, where else do we find that hyaline cartilage, by the way? Throughout adulthood. Now, the hyaline cartilage of the bone model, that gets replaced by true bone. But where does hyaline cartilage persist in adulthood? At joints in the form of articular cartilage, highly movable joints, that is, not all joints. Where else did you say? Yeah, where the ribs would normally directly be connected to the sternum, they're not directly connected to the sternum. Instead, between the rib and the sternum is a section of hyaline cartilage called the costal cartilages. Costal just means of the ribs. Okay, that's just a picture to kind of illustrate that ossification has not yet completed by the time of birth. Let's go on to 11 now, and this is also something that we discussed a little bit on Tuesday when I was talking about the transition from what we call the epiphyseal plate to what we eventually call the epiphyseal line. What's the difference between those phrases anatomically? It's not looking good for the day-by-day preparation for the test. So,
one is can still grow, and the other is still
growing. All right, that's partially toward the truth. So you're just hedging your bets by saying one can do it and one can. Which one? Right, the epiphyseal plate is still able to produce more tissue, and therefore only when a long bone has an epiphyseal plate, can it still grow in length? When that epiphyseal plate ossifies and turns to bone itself and is no longer cartilage, which is what the epiphyseal plate is, once you have just a line of bone rather than cartilage, then we say that the bone has closed, first of all, and that long bone can get no longer at that point. It can still get a little wider, thicker, in diameter, but it's not going to get any longer, and therefore that determines your statural height at that point in life. When does that occur usually?
20.
Yeah, it's well, different times in different bones, but usually it's complete in all the bones by about 20. So, by the way, speaking of growth in length, I mean in width, which is really not what this is about, but I'll talk about this in a minute. Bone undergoes what we call appositional growth to appose, that's with an A, not an O. To appose means to put onto the surface. So appositional growth is the only kind of growth that bone can undergo because it's completely hard. It can't grow from within, in other words. It has to only grow at the surface. Unless you destroy that bony part, which does happen in bone remodeling. But when you're adding new bone, bone is added appositionally, whereas cartilage can grow appositionally, appositional growth, but it can also undergo what we call endochondral growth, which literally means inside the cartilage. And the reason that endochondral growth is possible is because the extracellular matrix of cartilage isn't completely solid. It has some give to it. So if you add, you know, this is kind of like imagining blueberry muffin batter when you first put it into the oven. The blueberries are kind of like the chondroblasts. And the batter that surrounds them is like the extracellular matrix. And when you bake that, the whole thing gets bigger, right? and the batter expands, so there's more space. That increases the space between the blueberries. The whole thing is growing from within rather than just putting layers on the surface. Have you ever heard of blueberry muffins? Or is that just not a good analogy? It's a tasty analogy. That's what endochondral growth is. More extracellular matrix is added from within the cartilage itself. So it can grow at the surface and from within, but bone has to grow only at the surface. And that's what happens even after bone closure. You can still add to the thickness of the walls of the bone by appositional bone growth. But growth in length is what we're looking at here in this slide. And first of all, orient yourself to where we are. On the little picture at the top, that's a zoomed out view. That little tiny black rectangle is what we're looking up, or what we're looking at in close up for the main picture. And so we're really close up in here, which should be obvious because we can see individual cells. So this is a microscopic view. But we're looking at specifically the epiphyseal plate and a little bit of nearby tissue. Epiphyseal plate is cartilage, remember, and that is where new growth in length occurs. Now, in a long bone like the femur, meaning fairly long even for a long bone, then you'll have an epiphysis at each end, two epiphyses. So you'll have two epiphyseal plates, and the same thing will be happening on the bottom, which would be in the basement somewhere in terms of the size of this screen. There are five zones that contribute to this growth in length that's happening at the epiphyseal plate. And you can see that zone one is situated toward the middle of the thickness of the epiphyseal plate, and zone five is situated toward the diaphysis. So on the, if this is a bone that has two epiphyses, the other five zones would be in the reverse order. The zone fives would be toward each other, where the diaphysis is in the middle. Okay, and the other one would be upside down, in other words, compared to this one. So let's look at the zones, what they're called and what they do. Zone one is called the zone of reserve cartilage by some books. Other books call it the zone of resting cartilage. And even this book says that even though they call it the zone of reserve cartilage, they say that typical histology of resting hyaline cartilage. Resting cartilage means that it's not yet busy dividing. Not that it's not doing anything. It's not taking a nap. It's just not busy mitotically yet producing new cells. All right, so that's the one that's closest to the interior of the thickness of that cartilage band that we call the epiphyseal plate. Zone of cell proliferation is next. And what does it mean to proliferate? Growth in a tissue made up of cells can occur either of two ways, or both. Proliferation refers to an increase in number. So a tissue can get bigger because you are adding more cells, or it can get bigger because the cells that are in it each enlarge. Okay, those are two separate things, and they happen separately in two of these zones. So what happens first is proliferation. The cell number increases without the cells themselves getting bigger. And so cell proliferation takes place because chondrocytes are busy multiplying by mitosis. Okay? Notice that they're not just randomly positioned. They're starting to line up in little columns longitudinally. Columns whose axis is in parallel with the axis of the overall bone. And you can kind of see the columns with space between each column of multiple cells. All right, that produces more cells. That's what that's what proliferation is. But in the next zone, which is the zone of hypertrophy, they're no longer multiplying, but that now greater number of cells, each one of them is getting bigger, and which is what hypertrophy means, enlargement. All right, so no more mitosis, but the chondrocytes that were already produced in great numbers in the previous zone are now getting bigger. Now, these things are chondrocytes, and we've already talked about the fact that chondrocytes are in lacunae, just like osteocytes are in bone, only it's different extracellular matrix that they're locked in. But the, you know, if you consider two nearby chondrocytes, each in its lacuna, the extracellular matrix is kind of like a wall between the two lacunae. Those walls are what are thinning that it's talking about. Thinning of lacuna walls means that the growing cells are actually approaching each other because the extracellular matrix is being degraded. All right, that is all cartilage up to this point, still officially only cartilage. But in the zone of calcification, which is next, then we start having the hardening of that material. We've already talked about calcification. That's when there is mineralization that takes place. Deposits of mineral crystals start forming, and that turns the cartilage into calcified cartilage. Still not officially bone, but it's like halfway between bone and cartilage at this point. And then finally, the zone of bone deposition is when it officially ossifies. And this is when it's no longer officially cartilage. We have the death of the chondrocytes, which were named for the fact that they were in cartilage. Well, they're no longer needed. Now we need osteoblasts, right? Which makes sense because osteoblasts' job is to make additional hard, bony extracellular matrix, which is what they do, in the form of individual trabeculae that get wider and wider in diameter, and there's many trabeculae forming a network that looks like the sponge for which spongy bone or cancellous bone is named. By then, you're officially into bony material. Now, what you can think of is all of this stuff is happening behind the epiphyseal plate. These new cells that are added are kind of dropped off behind that resting cartilage line, and therefore the diaphysis gets a little longer as all this stuff is left behind the epiphyseal plate, which is moving with respect to the diaphysis as all of this is happening. And as long as that continues, the diaphysis will get longer and longer, and the epiphysis, which is on top of that, in this picture, on top of that epiphyseal plate, will be moved farther and farther away from the diaphysis as it grows. It's not really moving it farther away from the diaphysis. The diaphysis is getting longer, but the epiphysis is moving as well because it's on this non-stationary epiphyseal plate. Eventually, though, that epiphyseal plate itself will ossify. You'll have an epiphyseal line instead, and it will be pure bone. All right, now to 12. Some of this is information that you'll revisit in 202, if you decide to take 202 as well. But we'll talk about a little of it today as well. And seems like I remember talking about this a little bit. Did I talk about vitamin D?
Yeah.
In this course, right? Okay. Well, I'm going to talk about it again. Vitamins are named for the fact that they are vital, right? They perform vital functions, but for normal vitamins, they're classified that way because we can't make them on our own, remember? Vitamin D is an exception, though. It's not truly a vitamin because we can make our own vitamin D. And so it's really only classified as a vitamin if you are getting additional vitamin D in your diet, which we do. But even if you get none in your diet, you can still make some if you are insulated. That's insulation with an S-O-L, not S-U-L. That means being irradiated by sunlight. So if you live in a cave, you wouldn't make your own vitamin D. You'd have to supplement. But here we get plenty of sunlight. In fact, too much. Here's how it works, though. Cholesterol has many functions in the body, in animals. Animals make cholesterol. It's an important component of your plasma membranes, of every cell you have. It's also the precursor molecule for all the steroid hormones. So testosterone, estrogen, progesterone. They all start out as cholesterol, which just gets modified in one way or another. And actually very slightly. Testosterone and estrogen, for instance, which are kind of opposite in effect, one is feminizing, one is masculizing, have almost no difference. They look very much like that green molecule at the upper left. They have that same ring structure. The things that are hanging off of them, that ring, those rings are just slightly different. But anyway, and cholesterol is also an important component of bile, which your liver makes. Here's yet another use of it, though. In the skin, if sunlight strikes the skin, that sunlight provides the energy for a chemical reaction to occur that transforms that cholesterol into a molecule that we call cholecalciferol. And by the way, cholesterol itself, why does it have that name? Well, the C-H-O-L-E part, coal, does anyone know what that means? Any of my veterans already hear this speech in a different course? Coal means bile. It's another name for bile, which I just told you cholesterol is a component of. Stare, as in stereo, means solid or three-dimensional. And things that end in O-L mean what? Anyone had organic chemistry? Right. Things that end in O-L are alcohols. What defines an alcohol, by the way? It has a hydroxyl group on it, which means it has an O-H on it somewhere. And notice that cholesterol does, which is why it's cholesterol. So cholesterol literally means bile solid alcohol, because it was discovered in bile. That same use of coal, by the way, comes into play when you consider that another name for the gallbladder, which is a device for storing bile and concentrating it after it's been secreted by the liver, another name for the gallbladder is the cholecyst, which literally means bile bag. And there's a correspondingly named hormone called cholecystokinin, which stimulates the cholecyst or the gallbladder to contract. Anyway, that's 202 material. Let's get back to cholecalciferol. Cholecalciferol is not cholesterol anymore. Cholesterol has been converted into cholecalciferol at the skin, only if the skin receives sunlight. Okay, so that's what causes the chemical reaction to occur. And notice it's a pretty drastic rearrangement of the cholesterol molecule. It's much more of a rearrangement than you would have to do to create testosterone or estrogen from it. Those rings are separated now, and there are fewer of them. But anyway, cholecalciferol, notice it ends in OL as well. It still has a hydroxyl. That hasn't changed. So it's a single alcohol at this point. Cholecalciferol is in the skin, but it then travels, once it's produced, through the bloodstream to the liver. So the liver, the skin's job is done. The liver takes the cholecalciferol, which the skin produced, and sticks on a hydroxyl, another hydroxyl. It already had one, an OH. And so you can see the second OH now is in red to show you the job that liver cells did. So now it's a double alcohol because it has two hydroxyls on it. And that's why the name for this intermediate in the whole process of producing vitamin D is called calcidiol. Diol means two alcohols, two hydroxyls. Calcidiol is not yet the end product. It's a form of, these are all considered forms of vitamin D, but they are not the most active form of vitamin D yet. So calcidiol travels from the kidney that just made it, from the liver that just made it, to the kidneys. And the kidneys add still another hydroxyl to the mix. So another OH at the other end. Now it's a triple alcohol. And that's why at this point it's called calcitriol. Calcitriol is the active form of vitamin D. And it took several organs to make it, but you make it on your own, and therefore it really isn't truly a vitamin. Now once calcitriol is finally produced in that through these steps, then it can take on its actions, which are represented by the right side of the screen here. Calcitriol functions to allow cells in the epithelium of the small intestine, which are the cells that come into direct contact with the stuff that you eat that's passing through that alimentary canal, which remember is still outside of your body. It allows those cells to much more easily absorb and take into the body calcium from the diet, which is why this is called calcitriol, because it's involved in calcium absorption. But it's not just calcium, which is the Ca2+. It also helps absorb phosphate from the diet. Now, why is that important for the skeleton? Yeah. More specific, though. Calcium and phosphate produce what? Yes, extracellular matrix, but what specific part of the extracellular matrix? Hydroxyapatite, exactly, which is not the full extracellular matrix. What part of the extracellular matrix is hydroxyapatite?
Ground
substance, correct. Remember that every extracellular matrix has fibers and ground substance. Hydroxyapatite is the ground substance. The fibers are predominantly collagen. But that's why you need both of these things. They both have other uses, as we talked about. But as far as the skeleton is concerned, calcium and phosphate coming in are raw materials for building bone. But calcium and phosphate just by themselves are important for a whole host of other reasons like we talked about last time. Well, anyway, that's what the calcitriol allows to happen at the gut or the small intestine. It also operates at the kidney, or kidneys if you have two, to reduce the rate of excretion of calcium into the urine. Major job of kidneys is excretion, which means to filter the blood and get rid of things that shouldn't be there, but reabsorb things that got filtered out but are still good and you want to put back into the blood. So, depending on whether there's too much or too little calcium, the kidneys can either get rid of it or not get rid of it. Calcitriol tells the kidneys not to get rid of as much. Okay, and it also actually stimulates bone resorption. So bone can undergo resorption or deposition. Those are opposite functions, right? Deposition refers to building new bone. Resorption refers to dissolving the bone, to dissolving the hydroxyapatite in order to get the calcium to put it back into the blood. Okay. So those things are all done by calcitriol, which we can make on our own, starting with the skin. Let's go on to slide 13. We see two different disorders shown here, or two errors, in a sense. Wouldn't necessarily be disorders unless it's chronic, but they're both homeostatic errors. Remember that in homeostasis, you use feedback in order to reduce the magnitude of some error. What kind of feedback is used in homeostasis?
Negative
feedback, right. So there has to be an error, first of all, for you to get rid of that error. We're seeing two different errors in opposite directions here. They're errors with respect to the set point for proper blood calcium ion levels. So there's a set point for that. It should be within a narrow range for proper health. If it gets too high, we call that hypercalcemia. What does the emia part of that word mean?
Blood.
Correct. So hypercalcemia literally means too much calcium in the blood. Blood calcium levels too high. As you see by the red arrow. Blood calcium excess. So that's the error. The difference between what it should be and what it actually is not zero. There is an error. It's not quite perfect. So the body responds by secreting a hormone called calcitonin. Anyone know where calcitonin comes from? Which gland? You're not expected to know. I'm just curious. Which where? The thyroid gland. Correct. It's not the only thing it produces. Of course, the thyroid gland also produces thyroid hormones. But calcitonin is an additional hormone. And you can... The effect of calcitonin is to reduce the blood level of calcium, which is appropriate in this case, right? Because the error that caused its secretion was that calcium levels in the blood are too high. So you want to reduce it by negative feedback to bring it back to the set point. And notice that there's two major ways that calcitonin has its effect. So it will reduce the activity of osteoclasts. Now, why does that make sense? Because osteoclasts' job is to break bone down, which is going to create excess calcium being spilled into the blood, right? You don't want that to happen if blood calcium is already too high. So calcitonin tells the osteoclasts, just rest, don't do that. We already have enough calcium. On the other hand, it increases osteoblast activity. And that makes sense because the job of osteoblasts is to produce more extracellular matrix. To do that, they need more raw materials for that hydroxyapatite, which means they'll take calcium from the blood to do that. And taking calcium from the blood is appropriate when the blood calcium level is too high. So both of these combined effect is to return blood calcium ion concentration to a normal level. It's classic negative feedback. Once it returns to blood to normal, by the way, then the thyroid will stop secreting calcitonin, and therefore you won't keep reducing the level. Just the opposite problem is called hypocalcemia, literally too low a blood level of calcium. Either one of these, by the way, is really dangerous. Either one of them can kill you, which is why it's really important to keep it in such a narrow range. Well, the major hormone in charge of keeping blood calcium levels high enough, or the main hormone in charge of increasing blood calcium levels, is parathyroid hormone. Now, parathyroid hormone doesn't come from the thyroid gland. It comes from the parathyroid glands, of which there are four usually for people, could be more. But they're called that only because they're situated on the posterior surface of the thyroid gland. Okay, so that's they're totally different glands. But sometimes people have thyroidectomies, removal of the thyroid gland, and if that's not done properly, they sometimes have to take out the parathyroid glands as well, which is a bigger deal than removing the thyroid itself. They'll both require you to take hormones for the rest of your life if you don't have those organs, but the parathyroid hormone is more important hour to hour or day to day than the thyroid hormones are. But anyway, that's the reason they're called parathyroid gland. It just literally means on the thyroid. They're not actually part of the thyroid gland. And so the parathyroid glands produce what is called parathyroid hormone. And that is secreted in response to too low a level of calcium in the blood, hypocalcemia. Notice that there's four major ways that the parathyroid hormone responds or does its job. It will increase osteoclast activity, which of course is just the opposite of what calcitonin does, reasonably enough, because the error is in the other direction. But this is still negative feedback, remember. Even though the error is in the opposite direction, restoring the variable back to set point means you're negating the error, so it's still negative feedback. So increased osteoclast activity, of course, is going to free up some calcium that was in the bone for the blood. Reduced osteoblast activity is going to keep osteoblasts from building new bone and therefore from robbing the blood of calcium in order to do that, at least until there's enough calcium. But also, you're going to have more urine phosphate excretion. So the kidneys are going to respond to parathyroid hormone by increasing the amount of phosphate that is allowed to be kept in the urine rather than bringing it back in. So that's going to leave the body. Now the reason this makes sense is because if the phosphate were allowed to stay in along with the calcium, then there would be a likelihood that the two would react and form hydroxyapatite rather than being in the blood. What you want is just the calcium in the blood in this problem. So you don't want it to react with phosphate. That would essentially take it out of use and form hydroxyapatite. Therefore, you get rid of the extra phosphate and keep the calcium only. And so you can see that on the fourth one, which is also happening at the kidneys, the calcium is not allowed to be excreted. It's saved for the blood. Those all add up to having the effect of returning the blood calcium ion level to normal, at which case the parathyroid hormones will respond by stopping their production of parathyroid hormone. The error has been negated. All right, let's go on to 14 then. Here we're looking at the healing of a fracture, a bone fracture. And there's four major stages to how this happens, as you see. But if we have a fracture, obviously that is going to be kind of an emergency situation for the body, because a fractured bone cannot do its job of supporting whatever structure it's supporting. And therefore, immediately, things need to take place to get this bone back to a hard, supportive structure. The first thing to happen is that a hematoma forms, hematoma is just a big blood clot. Now, a blood clot isn't very hard material. Definitely not anywhere near as hard as a bone. So the hematoma basically just stops the bleeding, which is the first problem, because that alone can kill you, of course. Once the bleeding stops and the hematoma has formed, then the material in that hematoma starts to undergo granulation, and it becomes granulation tissue, as it's called, which is very slightly tougher stuff, but nowhere near as hard as it needs to be yet, of course. It's just the first part of the development of boniness in response to a fracture. Next, a soft callus forms, a so-called soft callus, because it's also not going to be nearly hard enough, but it's much more rigid than the hematoma itself that it replaces. So the soft callus is cartilage and collagen fibers. And that basically is a way to just get some structure there in the meantime. And it also gives a substrate on which bone formation can occur. So this is really kind of the same thing that happens developmentally, right? This is happening in adulthood, assuming this is when the fracture took place. Normally, you start with cartilage only fetally, and then that cartilage model gets ossified, like we've already talked about. But the same thing happens when you fracture a bone. You kind of go back in time to the developmental period just for that little part of bone, and you start with cartilage again, get that laid down first, and then the cartilage calcifies, and then it ossifies. And so when it starts to ossify, we call it the hard callus because it is much more rigid. And a so-called bony collar forms all around the periphery, the outside, like a ring. And it can be pretty pronounced in thickness because the bone has not yet fully ossified from within, so it's weaker. So you get a thick ring around it to stabilize it. And then you allow for further development, and eventually that ring will be remodeled into a thinner wall that looks like it was before it was fractured. So the hard callus forms, followed by bone remodeling. In bone remodeling, what happens is that spongy bone or cancellous bone that was laid down in the previous stage, which is the first bony stuff to be put down, or they're all trabeculae, basically. It's all cancellous bone that's laid down first. A lot of that spongy bone is then remodeled into compact bone, specifically at the surface. But also the cancellous bone itself is extensively remodeled to be more permanent and more reflective of the stresses that are going to be applied to that bone. So the trabeculae get rearranged, basically, and multiplied greatly. So there's a lot more of them. And if all goes well, which is usually, 6 weeks or so, then not only will you have a bone that is very difficult to even tell it was even fractured, if you were to look at it, but in most cases it's slightly thicker still than it was originally. So a properly healed bone is usually even a little stronger than the normal bone. But I don't recommend going out and breaking all your bones to get a stronger skeleton. That's not worth it. That is true, though. I think that might be it. Yeah, 15 is the standard ending where you see the interactions with other systems, but that's just for you. So I can speak for another half hour, or we can call it a week, or a day. No, there is the test still. No, it is the week, yeah. It is the week, right? Yeah.